Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we hear from a Verdon, Manitoba farmer about the potential for the Port of Churchill.
Really, Arctic shipping, in my opinion, is a way of the future.
John Gregg, editor of Farmtario, discusses the Ontario provincial election.
I think there's just a lack of living similar lives that results in an information disconnect.
And Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada deciphers the canola market. That's all on Between the Rows, with this week's host, Robert Arneson.
Hi, I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, and welcome to Between the Rows. After 2 years of uncertainty, the Port of Churchill may soon be back in business. On this week's show, we'll talk about the new owners of the Churchill Rail Line and the port, and what it means for prairie farmers. We'll also talk about the provincial election in Ontario and what it means for the agriculture industry. Finally, we'll have our weekly roundup of news from the commodity markets. First up on today's show, in late May, the federal government announced that there was a buyer for the Port of Churchill and the rail line that runs from the Paw, Manitoba to the town of Churchill. For decades, the port has handled Western Canadian grain, but it's been closed the last 2 years because flooding damaged the rail line in the summer of 2016. Join us to talk about the port and the new ownership group is Eldon Boone, president of the Hudson Bay Route Association, a group of farmers that promote the export of grain through Churchill. Eldon farms near Verdon, Manitoba. Hi, Eldon.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on the show. So, I guess it was in late May that the federal government made this announcement that they had found an ownership group to take over the port and the rail line. What can you tell us about this new group?
Yes, you know, for us, it's been a long time coming, but it's a historical partnership in the fact that it's going to be regionally owned. First Nations are involved in this. The Bayline communities, and by that I mean, you know, the places like Thompson and the Paw, Churchill, Gillam, Wolverton, and others. Those are Bayline communities. They're involved in this. And also the communities of Nunavut are part of this business partnership. Nunavut needs the supply line out of Manitoba for resupply, so they've been involved in this. Also, AGT, which is a pulse producer out of Regina, and Fairfax Financial. So for me and our association, all the key components are in place because now you've got regional ownership, which is always a better scenario, in my opinion. And you've got the grain industry involved here. You've got the financial industry, the investment industry also in it, and you've got the blessing of the feds on this. So I think that this now positions the port as an Arctic gateway.
So, you know, Omnitrax was a previous owner, and they were a company out of Denver. So can you explain this a little further? Like, what difference does it make for farmers that the rail line, the port now has more like local or regional ownership? How does that change things?
Well, I think it's for sure when you have a regional ownership, then everybody's got a skin in the game here. And I think it, in my opinion, that always makes a better business relationship. For farmers, you know, this port's always been, you know, in the past, kind of a relief valve in the grain industry when there's high production in the prairies. Churchill's always had higher numbers. I guess looking forward in the future here, northeast Saskatchewan, northwest Manitoba, there's just a huge advantage here for those areas utilizing this port. And that's what's really been lacking since this has been closed down for the last couple of years.
So, sorry to interrupt, but when you say huge advantage, you mean like it saves producers on shipping costs? That's the key advantage here?
Yeah, shipping costs, but also just getting rail car allocation in that area. Like any branch lines, in my opinion, in the future are going to struggle with rail car allocation. You know, we even struggle on main lines, but Northeast Saskatchewan has a lot of branch lines, and I know the short lines in that area are really struggling as when Churchill closed. The major grain companies do not want to handle producer cars, so that puts a real disadvantage to the short lines. I know one of our board members, our second vice president, is an investor in a short line up in the Melford area, and he says right now their main revenue off that line is rail car storage, not shipping grain on that. So it's just that the grain companies the grain companies are going to charge a fee for a larger fee for dealing with producer cars.
Okay.
So that's where the Port of Churchill comes into is a real advantage in that respect. So because it is an open port, and by that I mean that there isn't a Pacific Grain Company that owns that. So the smaller grain companies in Western Canada, the short line operators, all have an opportunity to utilize that port without having to negotiate tariffs from in Port of Vancouver, where the major grain companies own the ports. Yeah.
So, you know, when I look at the numbers, you know, I see that in maybe the last several years, I guess Canada's exported about 50 million tons of grain annually. But, you know, the volume that goes through the Port of Churchill, you're looking more like at about 300,000 to 500,000 tons. You know, it's kind of a small amount in the big picture. You kind of explain why it's important. Like, what kind of difference does it make for you personally on your farm? Does it affect the bottom line? Like, or is it more of a symbolic thing? How important is this to the average farmer in Western Manitoba, Northeast Saskatchewan?
Well, I guess, you know, from those of us that are outside of the traditional catchment area, it really probably doesn't have as much of an impact. But I think as farmers in Western Canada, I think we need to pay attention to our port assets, make sure they're all functional going forward. We all know that we have struggles getting grain to port position here in this country, whether it be rail service or congestion at our ports. So to me, I may not directly use the Port of Churchill, but I mean, I think for all of us, we need to make sure that all of our ports remain functional here going forward. And really, Arctic shipping, in my opinion, is a way of the future. And you know, it's always the distance is always shorter on the marine side of it. So it's key that we don't ignore something, an asset that could be very beneficial to us in the future here.
Okay. So what does the involvement of AGT mean? I mean, they're a major pulse exporter. Will that obviously, do you think, change the type of product that goes through Churchill?
I would think so, you know, and I, you know, I'm not sure what their plans are, but, there's an opportunity for container shipment through there, and, you know, some of the pulse industry deals in containers, so that's something that can be built into that, the Port of Churchill. That's something we've been trying to promote here for a number of years, container traffic. Doesn't take a huge infrastructure build to handle that at the port. I guess another thing that, you know, to be, for the Port of Churchill to be viable in the future, it needs to do import also. And that's something that hasn't been done. But there's a real opportunity there for importing, and I'll use phosphate fertilizer for one, because most of Western Canada imports all the phosphate into that area. the biggest phosphate reserves in the world. It was in Morocco and Northern Africa. So that's really got, logistics-wise, pretty close proximity to Churchill.
Okay.
So that would take an unload infrastructure built to do that, some transfer facilities. I think that's a win-win. If we look into the crystal ball in the future, the reserves that are in Florida are limited. There's a future there also.
Okay. So last question for you. I guess this is maybe the most important immediate question is that, do you think there will be a shipping season in 2018?
That I think will be a stretch. It depends how quickly they get on and to repairing this line and to what extent they will repair it temporarily and how much heavy traffic that can handle. It's going to take at least 6 weeks, maybe 2 months to do the repairs. So it depends on when they get started. So I'll remain optimistic, but I do think that it's going to be a little bit of a struggle to get that up and going this year, but you can sure build on next year for sure on that one. So.
Okay. Thanks, Eldon. I've been speaking about the Port of Churchill with Eldon Boone, president of the Hudson Bay Route Association. This is Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Later on in the show, we'll take a look at the latest news from the commodity markets. But up next, on June 7, voters in Ontario elect a new provincial government. The previous Liberal government was unpopular with farmers and residents of rural Ontario. But there's no guarantee that a new government will have a different stance on rural issues. Here to talk about the election and the potential impact on Ontario farmers is John Gregg, editor of Farmtario. Hi, John.
Hi, Robert.
So I guess, first off, how are farmers and folks in rural Ontario feeling about this election? Is there a sense that something needs to change?
Well, I think a lot of people in rural Ontario had the sense something needed to change, even at the last election when they essentially voted the Liberals completely out of any seats in rural Ontario. So certainly here we are, 4 years later, the sentiment hasn't changed at all. In fact, it may have even deepened. I think there's concerns about some fiscal issues with the number of deficits we've been running, the cost of electricity, the hike in minimum wage, and then respect and the feeling that rural Ontario and farmers are being heard at Queen's Park in Toronto.
So were there some specific policies related to agriculture that were unpopular?
That's actually part of the interesting point. It's not a lot of them were targeted. The ones that were of greatest concern were targeted to farmers, but they tended to have collateral damage on farms in rural Ontario. So an example is Green Energy Act, which put a large volume of wind turbines and solar panels into rural areas. Now, some farm families that benefited from those, but certainly they're kind of an obvious sitting out there in the field kind of reminder of the energy being sent to the cities. And then that Green Energy Act has really boosted the price of electricity, which has made it tougher for people who live in rural Ontario, and then as well farmers who do use quite a bit of electricity.
So I guess one issue that I remember from a couple of years ago, it's still lingering, I guess, is the Liberal government, imposing quite strict regulations around insecticide use, specifically neonics. Is that still an issue with farmers and the rural communities?
Yeah, I think that's a good symbolic issue. That is one that was very definitely targeted to the rural or to the ag sector, and yeah, certainly it is kind of an example that people will turn to when they look at the lack of consultation. The consultations for that was done during the summer busy time for farmers. It was done very quickly, and a lot of people were not so happy about that. And certainly, you know, even some opposition politicians I talked to during the election campaign made that point, that it was just kind of a symbolic lack of consultation. And then the policy itself that I think farmers felt was driven by urban concerns or urban urban understanding of what is a very complex issue in the survival of beehives and
right.
And what was a there was 1 year where there was a significant amount of bee deaths that were attributed to timing and the way that farmers were using were planting corn especially, and the sector made a whole bunch of changes to try to avoid that into the future, but the government still went ahead with the highly restrictive neonic regulations.
So it sounds like what you're describing to me in Ontario is quite a severe urban rural divide, I guess, in terms of culture and what people talk about, and also I guess voting preferences, obviously. I mean, how severe is the urban-rural divide in the province?
I think urban and rural people really just live different lives. And I think that lack of crossover these days, urban people they live within a fairly concentrated jurisdiction between their, between where they work and where they live and where, say, their children exist. And, they don't necessarily get out into the country all that much. And I don't think rural people necessarily get into the cities and have a good understanding of the issues and the concerns of people in the city. So, and as we are, even more urbanizing here in Ontario with, large cities, I think that's an issue that's going to continue to grow. And I don't think it's willful maliciousness. I don't think the urban people will tell you they dislike the people who live in the countryside and vice versa, but I think there's just a lack of living similar lives that results in an information disconnect. And then when people don't have information, they make assumptions, and then and those assumptions can sometimes end up into public policy. And as the urban voters are really, no matter what the rural people might like to think, they have the vast number of seats in the legislature, so they really do determine who gets elected.
So what are some of the things that farmers and rural citizens of Ontario want to see change? Obviously, it sounds like they want to have more of a voice at Queen's Park, at the legislature in Toronto. What are some specific things they want change in terms of policy?
Well, I think there is quite a bit of concern over the price of electricity. It's, it heats people's homes. It determines how well you can dry your grain and what you can do to in your barn these days with the large amounts of electricity that farmers do use. So I think that's a big one. And I think I talked to all the different political parties for a story on their agriculture policy. And, there's not that much difference in their policies. But I think the real concern is respect and being consulted. There's a proposal to build a high speed rail line between London and Toronto, and eventually Windsor to Toronto. And in the current plan, the environmental assessment is looking at one option, which basically would go right through some of the country's best farmland, and when you have a high-speed train, you have to cut off most of the roads. So I think that is a looming another potential respect and consultation issue that farmers will be watching to see how it's dealt with. And all the political parties, they all in principle support the idea of investigating it, but it'll be interesting to see. And they all told me they need more consultation, but it'll be interesting to see what actually happens after the election.
And last one here, I guess, use a key word earlier. You said respect. I guess maybe farmers and people of rural Ontario want, folks in Toronto and other places to respect, their contribution to the province and to the economy.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. There is some understanding of that. Certainly, I talked regularly enough with the Ontario Agriculture Minister, Jeff Leal, and he is a very, very big booster of the and tells me he is always bringing up the economic impact and economic contribution of of agriculture and rural to the to the provincial economy, and I think they get that. I think the politicians get that. Certainly, you see that even in some of the federal government work these days. They get that economic contribution. It's just whether, but it, that economic contribution doesn't necessarily translate into votes. So while they may recognize that, I'm not sure that much will change when the number of votes are really focused in the city.
Okay. Thanks, John. I've been speaking with John Gregg, editor of Farmtario, about the provincial election in Ontario. This is Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Canola futures have been trending down the last couple of weeks, possibly because of improved growing conditions in Western Canada. Here to talk about canola and other market news is Dave Sims, a reporter with Commodity News Service Canada. Dave joins us from Winnipeg. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Robert.
So I guess what's happening with canola futures the last little while? Why is the market weaker right now?
Well, yeah, you're right. It is a bit weaker, and a lot of the recent pressure, anyway, seems to have come from the rain we got. A lot of it, too, I guess, is just seasonal. Sometime around the end of May until the third week of June, when the crop gets in the ground and off to a good start, the market will just tend to go lower. So, when we think of, the past, 10 days or so, that rain we got really did help alleviate some of the dryness concerns we saw in much of Western Canada. And so coupled with kind of a seasonal trend lower, I think that's why we've seen the market kind of trend downward. Also, farmers are still holding on to old crop supplies, and some of them decided to liquidate old crop or are maybe starting to, and the market goes lower. And then, speculators around this time of the year will liquidate their positions, and so we go even lower heading into the summer, and it's just a cycle that seems to repeat itself time and time again. I wouldn't get too worried, though, at least not yet, that we're going to, plunge off a cliff or anything. Like, from a chart perspective, looking at the graphs, canola is really only at the bottom end of the range it's been in since mid-March. Now, if we were to, fall below $520 per ton, then, yeah, I think that might open the way lower on the technicals. Like, we might drift down somewhere to kind of just above 500. It's hard for me to see us going below 500 right now. There's just so much uncertainty, I guess, about how good the new crop's going to be. Like, we got the rain, but, everyone I talk to thinks, we're going to need more as the summer goes on periodically. And also, as you all know, there's so much volatility out there with the whole U.S., Canada trade relationship over NAFTA, and then that doesn't even include U.S. China, and of course U.S. Europe has kind of flared up recently. So, the decisions by Trump and the weather, they've got the potential to create dramatic swings in the marketplace.
Right.
And at the same time, the demand for canola is actually pretty strong right now, and it might even be a little bit stronger than normal. And having the U.S. and China mad at one another is good for canola if China needs oil seeds, which it does. And, I haven't even gotten into the Canadian dollar, which, of course, that's an issue pushing canola and supporting it. There's ideas now, and, of course, this changes every day, but, Trump wants to break up the joint talks with Canada and Mexico and deal with every country separately. So the dollar took it on the chin when that was announced, and it's weakened. So that's supportive for canola. So, that's just another wild card in the mix.
So it could be sort of a hectic or crazy summer for canola prices.
Yeah, well, when you look at all the, it's just more and more uncertainty. So, I think we are going to see some farmers hedging their bets. And, it's always a weather market, no matter what. But with some of the trade issues, I think that's just compounded even more.
So just shifting to corn for a second here. So I looked at some of the corn futures prices, and a couple of weeks ago, the futures were above $4 US a bushel, and now from what I saw yesterday, they're closer to about $3.80 a bushel. What's happening with corn futures right now?
Well, I think planting in the U.S. is off to a better start than people thought. You know, like, get back a month ago, and I mean, there was, concerns over drought, and there was too much rain in some parts of the eastern corn belt, so they actually got off to a slow start. But then, you know, we got some good weather, and these days, if U.S. farmers need to plant in a hurry, they can. So you're right. Like, yeah, it was the last few days of May. The front month corn contract was about $4. And now, yeah, $3.80, which seems to be kind of, a level of support for corn. But, and the thing that surprised me the most was that corn dropped so quickly. Like, corn, traditionally, like, you'll see it ebb and flow, like, 2 cents up and then, you know, maybe 3 cents down. And it went down 10 cents in one day, which is pretty rare. But with that, I heard the speculators were liquidating their long positions. And some traders are actually taking profits while they could. And, strength in the U.S. dollar weighs a bit on corn. I guess the damage could have even been a bit more, but we had that trucker strike in Brazil, which delayed it. That strike mainly impacted soybeans, but it also delayed some of the corn coming out of there. So that helped support U.S. corn. And, of course, the ethanol sector was helping right. a bit there, too.
So what about other crops? What are you watching or what's caught your attention recently?
We're always watching soybeans just to see the relationship between them and canola and soybeans. No surprise, they're definitely feeling the kind of the push and pull of Trump's decisions and the U.S. and China. I mean, they had that meeting over the weekend, but it looks like they're still pretty far apart from settling anything. So I think the tariffs on U.S. soybeans aren't going to be coming down anytime soon.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Dave. I've been speaking with Dave Sims, a reporter with Commodity News Service Canada. That's it for this week's show, the first one of June. This is Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.